back together again with you, chatting it up for a brand new week, Monday, December 9th, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today, where I wondered how Democrats still don't understand how and why Donald Trump was elected again last month. Blogger Chris Powell stopped by, joining us to talk about the continuing problems of violence and poverty in the state's cities and the legacy of the late Governor Jody Rell. And at University of New Haven, Professor of National Security, Dr. Howard Stouffer joined us again to detail the fall of Syria's government over the weekend.
All right, open phones. We'll pick it up. Got a couple of guests coming up later on. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. I was relaxing and reading over the weekend a lot of op-ed stuff regarding the win about 5 weeks ago. Of 5 weeks ago tomorrow, I guess. Yeah, maybe. Am I figuring that right? Anyway, of Donald Trump. Again, you know, unexpected by a lot of folks, including myself. But I'm reading about some politicos in and about Connecticut and, you know, what they want to do and the key for the Democrats to win things back, which they might. Again, like I said, there's a, you know, the midterm elections coming up in 2026. It's a wonderful opportunity that our founders gave us every 2 years, if we don't elect a chief executive, to kind of do a little bit of a reset here. But I got to tell you, a lot of them out there still don't get it. They still don't get it. And I hate to say this, even among people that I like and I admire and I've talked to in the past, you know, including former 4th District Congressman Christopher Shays. And I guess at this juncture, Chris Shays is still the last Republican House member to be elected in all of New England. So he had an op-ed in the Connecticut Insider that was published actually today, where Kamala Harris went wrong. And Chris Shays, and with all due respect to former Congressman Shays, I've chatted with him numerous times over the years. Talked with him when he ran for governor. I guess it was in 2012, I think, when he was in the Republican primary. It all becomes a blur after a while. Now, he starts off with a supposition here that I kind of agree with. And I'm not going to go line by line in this thing, but you read into it and you read a lot of this stuff by people and you say they still don't get it. His first line in this is, quote, "I thought Kamala Harris would win the election for president comfortably," unquote. Then he goes into the reasons and everything. But yeah, I thought she would win. I did, but she didn't. And then the more I think about it, I say, well, yeah, it kind of makes sense now. But he does go on to say this. "The Harris campaign spent and wasted literally hundreds of millions of dollars reminding us that Donald Trump was a misogynist, a sex offender, an election denier, a convicted felon, a fascist." See, I don't agree with that. I don't care who throws it around. Stop throwing around the word fascist when you've never lived or associated with a fascist country. "Who has zero appreciation for the sanctity of truth and the momentousness of the rule of law." On and on and on. But he continues here, "What the voters did not know was who really Kamala Harris was. They did know she was an African-American and a woman, which was clearly not a plus to some voters. What they wondered was she truly a candidate for change? Faithfully committed," here's my favorite here, "faithfully committed to chart a more centrist course, given her liberal views as a senator from California," on and on and on. You know, with all due respect, Congressman Shays, that's the point right there. They didn't believe her. She was a lousy candidate whose appearances here had no substance. They had to pay hip-hop acts and rap acts and dancers and come in to do, you know, it was like combination concerts and campaign rallies. She was an empty suit. And you've got Chris Shays, and a little bit later on we'll get into the word over the weekend now from the Hill that, hey, this Chris Murphy guy from Connecticut, maybe we should listen to him. But how are people still wondering why Donald Trump won? You may not like to agree with it. You may not like to even think about it. It may bring tears to your eyes. That's not the point. The point is, he won because people's cash register tapes at Stop and Shop and at Aldi and at Big Y and all that, they were too expensive. That's why he won. Why else did he win? Because you people on the left have this fascination with transgenders in sports, and only after she lost did Seth Moulton, considered a up-and-comer in Democratic politics in Massachusetts, congressman, kind of a centrist guy, represents some suburban Boston neighborhoods to the north of Beantown. He comes out 2 days later and said, well, yeah, you know, we're too big into this transgender thing. You think, congressman? Jeez, thanks, Dick Tracy. How did you figure that out? And then I'm reading a piece, and these aren't in far right-wing websites. I'm seeing stuff in Politico and seeing stuff, you know, on the Hill, you know, privately, I'm paraphrasing now, privately, Democrats were whispering that their border policy was a non-starter. Gee, you think? You think maybe some people in your own party and some independents watched the video of people crossing the border night after night after night after night and day after day after day and say, yeah, you know what? Trump's a creep. I can't stand him, but I think he'll shut down the border. You don't think that happened? And we got Chris Murphy talking about, well, maybe it's the economic populism, and to a point, maybe it is. But good God. You people out there, can you be this dumb? Maybe dumb is too harsh. Can you be this blinded? Yes. Like Chris Shays says in his piece, a lot of people realize in their minds, Donald Trump is a creep. Guess what? They don't care. They don't care. And I'm reading stuff over the weekend. Well, you know, I'm seeing stuff all over the place. Well, you know, when people find out that they can't get their lawns cut, they'll blame Donald Trump. No, they won't. No, they won't. They'll blame Joe Biden, and they'll blame Kamala Harris. Oh, my God. Well, you know, when their salads cost $2 more, they're not going to care. What they do care about is they don't want to see the video of people coming across the border. They know that. They're adults. They can figure all this out. But my God, some of this stuff, some of this revisionist history stuff. Oh, my God. And Chris Murphy said, well, you know, we have to figure out how to get again into economic populism. No, you've got to figure out how not to look at transgenderism as a freaking sacrament. You've got to get enough people in your own party, Senator, with all due respect, who can come in front of a bunch of microphones saying, hey, yeah, the border is not good. Right now in your party, nobody has got the spine or iguglioni or, shall I say, the Paulines or the castanets, figuratively, ladies, of course, to do that. Yes, the economy was big, but you know what? People, maybe sometimes they like a big set of, well, you know, croquet mallets, whatever. They know who Trump is, but my God, this revisionist history. Now, well, you know, if we just do this and we just say this, shut the border down. You want to win again in 2026 and 2028? Dude, and I don't want to hear, well, you know, your lettuce is going to cost more. Most people don't care. They don't care. They don't. Most people don't want their nieces or granddaughters or daughters playing against guys in some sports. I know it doesn't happen a lot, but it does. And more than a few people might not think that we should have virtually like drive-through abortions in the state. And I know that we don't, but you know what I mean. Hey, has William Tong opened another abortion line again? I mean, after a while, even people will look at a guy like Trump and say, enough. Right now, our monthly check-in with Chris Powell. Go to ChrisPowellColumn.com, ChrisPowellColumn.com for his thoughts and opinions. Mr. Powell, good afternoon, sir. It's been a while. How are you?
I'm good, Paul. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, thanks, Chris, for checking in. We appreciate it. You had some thoughts here on the passing, I know, of former Connecticut Governor Jody Rell. And interesting, because I do remember that although she provided some stabilizing stewardship here, as you point out, some of the fiscal remnants of those years were not really corrected.
Yeah, she made people very happy with her demeanor, but the state's financial position after she achieved her election to a full term was just deteriorating. She didn't want to make the hard choices that, you know, we're still not really wanting to make in government finance. There was more diversion of pension funds. She proposed a huge increase in education spending, and when even the Democrats balked at it, she withdrew the proposal. I think she would have been reelected if she'd sought a second term of her own back in 2010. But a recession was already on Connecticut, and there would be no avoiding the hard choices. I think she just decided to retire rather than face up to those hard choices, and she left them for Dan Malloy. On the other hand, she was you know, honest and decent and reasonable and cordial. She did sign the Citizens Election Program legislation. I don't think it has probably made much difference for the way Connecticut's been going, but it did make campaigning a little easier for ordinary people running for the legislature, and I think that was good. But I think the thing that sticks with me about her administration is that she had a huge amount of political capital and public goodwill when she succeeded Rowland. People were so relieved to be rid of the scandal and the dissembling of the last years of the Rowland administration. She was very popular. People trusted her. And I just don't think she did anything with the political capital she had. I just think she was too interested in protecting her image and not her legacy.
And you talk about spending, Chris Powell. The guest is Chris Powell. Go to ChrisPowellColumn.com. You talk, Chris, about spending, and your newest column coming out, you know, talks about spending now and the constant pressure that's already building on the legislature and on Governor Ned Lamont to do whatever they can to get around those, you know, those guardrails. And there's always this social program pressure here, even at a time where, you know, we're far from correcting the fiscal malpractice here, but at least we're a little bit on the road here. But those pressures are building again, as you notice.
Yeah, you know, the Democrats have lots of hungry mouths to feed, and they want to spend and spend and spend, and you know, they're looking at what is a nominal surplus in state governments' accounts. But, you know, much of that money is just federal inflation money, federal, you know, COVID emergency money. That's going away. It has come to us at a very high cost of inflation over the last few years. The real inflation rate's probably been much closer to 25% than the, you know, 4 or 5% the government tells us about. The other thing is that the progress that state government is claiming in paying down its unfunded pension liabilities is really illusionary. I think probably the most important columns on Connecticut government this year have been written by Red Jahnke, who's a business analyst. He has noted that while we've been paying down the unfunded pension debt, we've been running it up, on the other hand, through the huge raises that the Lamont administration has been awarding to the state employee unions, because the pensions are a function of the salaries. If you raise the salaries, you raise the pension liabilities. And so while, you know, we're claiming that we've reduced the pension liabilities by, you know, billions of dollars, Jahnke calculated that when you take the raises into account and the increase in pension liabilities, we've actually reduced the pension liabilities very little.
Yeah.
And so our state's fiscal position is really not half as good as they're telling us.
It's almost like when you go into New York City, Chris, and you're going to see the tree in Rockefeller Center, and you used to, I guess these aren't around as they much as they used to be, you pass those three-card Monty games, right? And you're like, well, I can believe this, and whoever's with you say, no, walk away, right? Because this is all rigged.
Yeah, well, we've paid a lot of money into the pension fund, but we've only taken it away, most of it away, with the big raises that we've been giving the state employee union, which are really the Democratic Party's political army.
And finally, Chris, a couple of your columns recently, you allude to something that I'm glad you do, and I try to mention it on the show here, the continued battle we have in this state, and particularly with our big cities, that we've been battling for five and six, I think going on seven decades, a lot of the violence, the shootings, and, you know, you do have this kind of permanent underclass beset with poverty, but yet you have the mayors saying, hey, everything is fine. No, everything is not fine, and we still have this layer of violence that just seems to just stick with us.
Yeah, well, Mayor Elicker in New Haven the other day, he was responding to where there were three fatal shootings of young men in the city in 2 weeks, and he was trying to tell suburbanites that, look, the city's really still safe enough to come into because in New Haven, just as in all the cities around the country, the shootings almost always involve people who know each other. I thought that the inverse of this argument was that the mayor was telling people you'll be perfectly safe if you come to New Haven as long as you don't know anybody there. You know, I know he was just trying to protect the image of his city and the beginning of the Christmas season for the shopping and the holiday events and everything like that. But it wasn't terribly reassuring to me that we keep living with this underclass in the cities, a really permanent state of violence. All these young men growing up without fathers, and I've just been trying to get people to look at the policies that have been causing this fatherlessness and violence. I mean, the welfare system takes fathers away from the poor boys, born into a fatherless family, and then they go to school, and what does school tell them? School tells them, look, we're not going to ask anything of you. You don't have to learn anything in school because our only policy now in public education in Connecticut is social promotion. So, we promote people and give them high school diplomas, even if they know nothing, like the kid who was graduated from Hartford Public High School recently, and there was a big scandal about it.
Yeah.
She was illiterate. Well, you know what? Half the kids coming out of high school in Connecticut now have never mastered high school work. What do we expect these kids to do when they grow up? They're uneducated. They're qualified really only for menial work. Many of them are demoralized by their upbringing without a father. What do we expect the future holds for us? Do we think these people are prepared to be citizens? They're not even prepared to support themselves.
And it's been going on five or six decades like this, too. Chris, thank you. Chris Powell, a monthly check-in. Chris, if we don't talk, have a great holiday season. We'll talk in 2025. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Chris Powell there. All right. As you were relaxing and luxuriating home over the weekend, hope you had a nice time with whomever you were hanging out with at Su Casa over the weekend. You probably saw the news that the Assad regime, which between Hafez Assad and Bashar al-Assad, had fallen finally after decades in control in Syria. What does this all mean? Joining us right now is one of our go-to folks, University of New Haven professor of national security and a longtime employee in the Federal Foreign Service, Dr. Howard Stouffer joins us. Dr. Stouffer, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, Dr. Stouffer, were you surprised here? What was your reaction when you saw the news break over the weekend?
Oh, I was quite surprised. I mean, Assad had took over in 1970, Hafez Assad, and his son in 2003, and I never expected the regime to fall so fast. But there's a lot of reasons to be looking at all of the factors that have led to this.
Sure. Okay. So lay it out for our listeners here who may not be completely in tune here. This was a civil war that's been going on, what, Dr. Stowe, for about 13 years or so, right?
Yeah, it started in 2011 when the Arab Spring was occurring all over the Arab region for people to say we want to control our own lives, get rid of all the dictators. But Bashar Assad started killing people, mowing them down, and murdering large numbers of people, using chemical weapons against them in 2013. So it's been a brutal war, and backed up by Iran, backed up by the Russians. Mm-hmm. So why is this happening now? One of the reasons is because the Israelis have gone after Hezbollah, so absolutely in a concentrated way, to kill off their leadership, blow up their military supplies, and to basically break down their ability to operate in Syria and even in Lebanon. And, of course, Iran attacked Israel twice. Israel attacked them the second time, blowing up their missile factories, destroying their air defenses. They have no way of projecting significant power into Syria anymore, even after that. So with those two things happening, plus the war in Ukraine weakening the Russians, so the Russians really can't do very much in Syria in order to prop up the regime, all of this gave the green light for the rebels in the north to go into Aleppo. Then they moved south to Hama, moved south to Homs, mm-hmm. and then the rebels in the south moved into Damascus 2 days ago, and the regime just collapsed. No one was going to fight and die for a guy who was getting ready to get on a plane and fly to Moscow.
Yeah.
So the regime collapsed. And this new leadership is now going to be defining the future for Syria.
Okay, so what about that leadership, Dr. Stouffer? Who do you think they might align with? Who is it, if do we know anything? And could this possibly be a bad situation for a while, or is there going to be some immediate structure there? What do you think?
Well, the guy's name is Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, also referred to in the press now as HTS. So okay. When you hear HTS, that's the guy. He used to be with al-Qaeda many years ago. He was in an American prison in Iraq for a number of years. But he seems to be a pretty wise leader. He said, for example, I don't want to make the mistake the Americans did in Iraq. I'm asking everybody who worked for the Assad regime to stay in their jobs, the police to stay in their jobs. We're not getting rid of anybody. And
he's kind of giving people a second chance here.
Amnesty.
I know the word, yeah. Yeah.
Amnesty.
Yes.
Giving amnesty
yep.
to all of the conscripted soldiers. So, and they opened up the prison, so everybody who's had people that Assad locked up by thousands and even more mm-hmm. Over the years, they're all out now. So he's basically trying to take power in a very, systematic and careful way. And of course, the United States is doing a few things. We have 1,000 soldiers in southern Syria. We've been bombing ISIS places there to remind them that, if you think this is an opportunity to take over, you're going to face serious American resistance. The United States is trying to lock down the chemical weapons that allegedly Assad got rid of in 2013 and still had. The United States has sent in special forces to be able to secure those weapons and to get them out of the country if possible. That's not in the press, but that is what we're doing.
Mm.
And on top of that, the Pentagon has even announced that they're taking steps to prevent chemical weapons that Assad had from getting in the wrong hands. So Israel is now moving forces into the top of Golan Heights, which touches Syria. They've gone into the UN area, which is the buffer zone, and they're actually going beyond that so that they take all the high points and prevent any forces that this guy may want to, go after Israel for. He will be on the low ground. He'll be in no position to be able to threaten the Golan Heights in a significant way. And he doesn't appear to be doing that, not at all. So peacekeepers are still there in that zone. The other interesting thing is that, in the north, you have the Turks who are, trying to support their Kurdish forces, and they're fighting the American Kurdish forces. So there's still been fighting going on there in the north. It's not completely settled at all. And Turkey thinks that they're going to be the new sponsor for Syria. They may try to fulfill that role. And that'll create a problem for us because they're an ally. They're a NATO ally. And we have to see how we're going to treat Syria, depending on how far it goes. Interestingly, one other element I want to mention is that Syria is saying it's opening the border with Syria so that all of the voluntary return of migrants can take place. Syria has been hosting 2.9 million refugees since the beginning of this thing in 2011.
Yeah.
Plus, in Germany and Austria, they're not giving asylum applications to Syrians anymore. They expect now Syrians who had, you know, sprinkled themselves all over Europe to start making their way back to Syria once it looks like it's a stable place. That'll be a good thing.
Yeah.
Because then Europe won't have all of these kind of conflicts between Muslims and particularly Syrian Muslims and the native populations of Germany, the UK, France, and Austria, and other places like that.
What is the dynamic, Dr. Stoffer, now with this new leader in Syria, Sunni versus Shia? I know that's always a dynamic in different parts of the Middle East. How is that shaking out? Is that a problem or not?
Well, it's a huge thing. I mean, Iran is the leaders of the Shia movement, and they have taken over parts of, you know, Iraq, and they took over most of Syria, and they used Iraq and Syria to move weapons into Lebanon to host their Hezbollah allies, who can then bomb Israel and put pressure on Israel, northern Israel, for all these years. All of that's finished. The entire, you know, effort by the Iranians to, you know, create a phalanx of states that are Shia states is in serious jeopardy. And certainly it's over in Syria. Syria is going to be a Shia. It's not going to be a Shia state. It's going to be a Sunni state because al-Qaeda is Sunni. And this guy, HTS, is Sunni.
Okay.
So the Shia are finished, basically, in Syria. And so that is a huge setback for Iran. And Iran, you know, has to recalculate what it's going to do. It certainly is not going to be the axis of resistance that it once was. And we have to see how this guy, this new leader, if he is smart, if he plays his cards right, he opens up to the United States. The United States said it's open to talking to him. They're ready to talk to him. They're ready to see what he has to offer. This could be a new dynamic, but it's a dangerous time. Dangerous for Israel, dangerous for the United States, and for the entire region.
And finally, in about the minute we have left, Dr. Stoffer, so in the lead-up to this, the last couple of weeks or months when this finally happened, or maybe longer past, do you think there was any sort of direct help or intelligence or something off the books from Israel and or the U.S. pushing to get this Assad government to fall or not?
I don't think that was in the cards for a long time. I think we were just so focused on Hamas, and now Hamas has been pulverized. And you know, despite all the other controversies surrounding that, Israel is continuing its operations there. Israel then decided at a certain point that Hezbollah was just, you know, not being reasonable. They destroyed the leadership. They killed Nasrallah, who was the head of Hezbollah. All of the other leaders that were working for him. So Hezbollah has been neutered. So that means Lebanon is a different country than it was before.
Wow.
And now Syria is a different country. And I guess, you know, the analysts in CIA and at State and other places should have been, and I'm sure they have been putting out together reports, like if Israel is going after Hamas, Hezbollah, and it's going to be and attacking Iran directly as it did the second time after Iran attacked them a second time, that there's going to be consequences. And these consequences are that Assad's going to have no support. It really shows that the Russians can't give any support anymore. They're stretched too thin.
Yeah.
They can't. They didn't. The Iranians certainly couldn't give them any support. And then even the Russians, all they wanted to do was protect their two bases, their naval and air base at Latakia. But they have no way of being able to fight these rebels. And so as a consequence, you know, Putin is much weaker than he was before.
Interesting.
And and that makes him much more dangerous because now one of his major allies, Syria, is gone.
Sure. Always good explanation. Dr. Howard Stoffer, University of New Haven. Dr. Stoffer, thank you, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
All Bye-bye. Right, Dr. Howard Stoffer, there you go. Laying it out for you right here on WICC.